If you'd like to make a contribution, could you please indicate via the reactions button that you can will find on your screen at the bottom if you're using Windows. I don't know where Paul Bennett will find it on his Apple, but he already knows that anyway. So if you could raise your hand, please, if you'd like to make a contribution. And that's Paddy, his hand up. Paddy, go ahead, please.
I appear to be the Socialist Party. I thought I was okay. I've got confused about my sign on. I thought it was really interesting. I enjoyed that bill a lot. I thought the idea of actually having kind of, do they call them intentional communities? Is that what they call them? Really interesting. And particularly so because I just saw, I think some people recently probably saw this on BBC iPlayer, a thing called the Broderhof community. I don't know if you saw that, Bill. It's called Inside the Broderhof. I've just checked actually, and it's not on BBC iPlayer anymore. But it is on YouTube. I can post the link in a note. It's a religious community, but I mean, I thought what you were saying was really interesting because I was sort of half, I had it in mind to sort of contact them and ask them the question, you know, do you think this kind of community that you've got here is very, very socialistic? Let me just say that. It's very, very social. It's very, you know, they don't own anything in common. They don't own any private property. They don't use money. They share everything. They do communal work. They sort of seem, you know, quite contented in a lot of ways. And they've been going for, I think the Broderhof thing started in the 1920s, I think. They all wear really 1920s clothes, especially the women. It's all, you know, there are sorts of questionable aspects to it. But it's really interesting to see how they're right. They exist right now. You know, these are not historical things. They exist right now in Sussex. Plus, they've got other communities, mostly in America. Anyway, and I was curious about asking them, you know, do you think, is it the religion that holds it? Well, it obviously is the religion that holds them together, but, you know, could they imagine, you know, a non-religious organisation sticking together? And I was interested by what their answer to that might be. But I struggle to imagine a non-religious sort of group, you know, like us, actually doing something like that for real, for a number of reasons. I mean, the way that the Broderhof sort of succeeds, it seems to me, is what they do is they shut out capitalist society. They sort of live in a kind of self-imposed solitary confinement where the kids up to the age of 18 get no access to phones, get no access to TV. They never see the TV. They never see films. They never see YouTube or the computer or computers or anything like that. And when they do get to be 18, they are allowed to sort of leave and discover the real world. But of course, they're so institutionalized by this point that, you know, the sort of culture shock of encountering the real world, the capitalist world, is very often just, you know, too much for them, and two thirds of them go back to the Broderhof community. And this BBC documentary, it's only a short thing, 30-minute thing, it sort of charts the progress of one 18-year-old girl as she leaves this community and goes and lives in Peckham in London, in North London. Is it North London? No, it's actually, I don't know. Can't remember. I should know this. I'm from London. Anyway, and going around the markets and thinking, look at all this crap. Look at all this kind of materialistic crap. You know, like we never use any of this stuff in our community. Why do people even want this stuff? Anyway, it's absolutely fascinating watch. And I thought what was most fascinating about it was it makes you realise how feasible the socialist kind of model of living is. You know, leave aside the compromises that they've made in order to make this possible, like, you know, they shut out the outside world, leave all that aside, The fact that they actually can live like that, and are pretty happily for the most part, they all seem pretty content. It all works. They've got no desire for money. They've got no. There's no question of like, what do we do with the free riders? What do we do with the people in our community who won't work? It just doesn't arise. It just doesn't happen. Everybody wants to contribute. So I thought it was an amazing sort of sort of confirmation of everything, you know, we've always said. But in practice, this is a community that really that exists right now. On top of all the ones that you mentioned, Bill, it even made me tempted to think, you know, with the money that we've got stored up, would there be any sort of mileage in us trying to set up such a community? Maybe not of party members, because they'd probably all kill each other, but just, you know, suitable people who, you know, were willing to buy in, because this in the Broderhof, they actually have to buy in. You can't just like walk up and go, oh, I want to join, please let me in. You know, you have to show that you're committed by, you know, selling your house or whatever, and then so that you've got a stake so that you can then buy in to show that you're serious, that sort of thing. Anyway, I only toyed with the idea because I thought there are all kinds of reasons why that wouldn't be a good idea. But it, you know, to have an actual working society like that, that you can then point people to and just say, well, you think socialism is unfeasible. You think that there would be the free rider problem. You think human nature is a big problem. Look at this community. Look at that. Go and study that and look at the documentaries on it. And then tell us it can't happen, because it blatantly can. It's not against human nature. It really can happen. And there are the communities there to prove it. Anyway, sorry, that was a bit of a ramble. I wasn't even asking a question, except, oh, had you heard of the Broderhof community? There was my question. There you go.
Do you want to answer that, Bill?
Well, but very, very briefly, it's just reminded me of two things that I should have put into the top. One is, I've not heard of the Broderhofs, but I will have to look up this video. But just quickly on a couple of points. One is that obviously, within a broader point, I've often used the example that the medieval monasteries are a form of communism, that in as much as they are communally owned and operated by the monks generally, that's lasted for thousands of years, and that there is this long stream of practical socialism from the religious side. But also, what it reminded me, you mentioned just, but the one of the issues, I suppose, that you have to think about these days is the healthcare. Whereas, you know, living on a farm in the 19th century America, you'd have the same life chances and the same access to healthcare, come what may. But nowadays, in the modern world, shutting yourself off from the modern world is shutting yourself off from cancer care or all sorts of fairly readily available remedies that, you know, mean that, you know, we don't die of dropping dead disease. And I suppose that's something that you have to contrast against the apparent simplicity of these communities that exist outside. And yes, I've heard about similar stories about how the Amish let their kids go at a certain age, knowing that they're going to come back going, oh my God, I've just taken all the drugs in the world and I can't take it. I want to stay being Amish. Yes.
Alan Johnston, please.
It was just a few comments I wanted to make that people might not realise was Eugene Debs, the American socialist, in between his railway activities and becoming a member of the Socialist Party of America, he promoted the idea of going westward and creating Commonwealth colonies. However, after debates, etc., they decided that it had to be a social revolution change, and he became a political activist rather than a communard. The other thing is the American Party, Stephen Shenfield, has written on another aspect, the People's Temple, Jim Jones, and his attempts at socialism. You can go to the website, and he's written a few articles on Jim Jones's attempts with People's Temple. Another thing is our own Scottish blog, Socialist Courier, has written about Orbiston. This was a sort of new Lanark sort of style, which people probably have heard of. But Orbiston, called Babylon, another religious name, was set up for several years before it went bankrupt. And I think a couple of them ended up in paupers' prison as debtors. And the other thing is, when you mention the two-tier situation, you find a lot of cooperatives operating like that, with bringing in outside labour. Mondragon in Spain, the Basque region, they're very famous among the leftists, but people don't realise that there's second-class members who don't have the full voting rights, who don't get the full benefits of being part of Mondragon, and they're just used basically as cheap labour to subsidise the privileges of the full members. These things I just thought I would just bring up.
Okay, thanks, Alan. If you want to make a comment, Bill, otherwise I'll go to Mike Foster. Okay, Mike Foster, then, please.
You're right there. Thanks, Bill. Yeah, I found that really interesting. Yeah, I enjoyed that. Yeah, thank you. And I've got quite a soft spot myself for some of these communal living experiments. Back in the mid-90s, I went on a sort of join a commune weekend. It was somewhere sort of southwest of London, I think. It was sort of in a big stately home, and it was run as a sort of legally as a cooperative. And the 20 or so people in there, they didn't sort of aim for self-sufficiency. I think they had, grew vegetables and kept bees, that kind of thing, but lots of them had jobs nearby. And, it seemed like a sort of a nice bunch of people who'd found a way of living that suits them. It wasn't sort of overly political, though. There weren't sort of, posters everywhere. It didn't sort of seem to be motivated by politics, but more by sort of personal sort of lifestyle choices. And I suppose that makes me think that, there's a distinction between what these kinds of places or the other kinds which have been mentioned, the religious ones as well. There's a distinction between how much of a template their way of doing things, in terms of sharing and cooperation, is a sort of a practical, pointer to a socialist society. And so there's that way of looking at it, and also what that way of living and working, what kind of mindset or set of values it encourages, the sort of the psychological aspects of their communities as well as the practical ones. So there's that sort of distinction and two ways of looking at them. And I'll say that these kinds of communities create a similar kind of mindset to the mindset that people would need to make socialism work, but whether or not they're a practical template, and if the way they do things can be scaled up, that's a more complicated question, because obviously you have to factor in that they're operating at the moment within capitalism, and still have to buy and sell things, even if vegetables grown on site are just shared rather than treated as commodities. So yeah, I suppose that was my point, really. There's two different ways of looking at the potentials of these kinds of settlements. But interesting. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, cheers.
Just on the mindset, I mean, one other thing that I couldn't really bring into the talk, there's this question of, I mean, recently there's been this issue of, I can't exactly how it worked out, that there was sexual abuse going on within the Amish community. Because they were very insular and hierarchical, it was people of significant rank. And you know, obviously we have no way of knowing if in the perfectionists' time and the polyamory, how just exactly how free the love really was. And there's no way of knowing exactly how much abuse and interpersonal rivalry there is, you know, in the pressure cooker of these communal organizations. I think you're right. It's an interesting question to the extent of, I suppose it's very like, you know, the kind of like the leftist argument of, you know, if we get people to just go and do it, then they'll develop socialist consciousness just from doing it. So if people just go and live in a commune, they will therefore develop socialist consciousness, rather than people who have to be motivated prior to going in by the idea that they're doing this to be socialistic and to live in this sort of commune and live in the sharing. And I think that from the looks of the nod off, I think that that there has to be some prior idea that motivates it. And I think that's the bit that we can take away, is that, you know, what we've always said, that socialist consciousness has to pre-exist before we can have socialism. And I think that that's a key takeaway for us from these sorts of communes.
Anybody else got a contribution they'd like to make or a question? Howard, please. Comrade Moss.
My question is a simple one, Bill. Do we really want to associate ourselves in any shape or form with these communities and with the way they organize themselves and the sort of ideology behind the way they organize themselves? Isn't it something more negative than positive? If we point to them and say, look, it can work. Look at those people in the 19th century. They did it and it was relatively successful. Do we really want to sort of be associated with them?
No, I don't think that. No, I think because you're right. I mean, the point of my talk is that we don't, because the world has very significantly changed, and that is not a route that we can go down. We can't build communes and live in them, and we can't live in that kind of subsistence way. There's literally too many people, not enough land, and that we need to do. I think that the value of them is in the extent that they demonstrate that there was a clear idea of communism as everyone lives. There's no buying or selling, and people share, and also that there is a clear idea that of, you know, everyone works, but there's the abundance creates a kind of leisure for all, and they are a kind of proof of concept in some ways, but certainly I don't think that we want to be associated with them as they are. I was listening to Paddy and I was thinking that one of the things that people come around and turn on you and go is, oh, you all want us to live on turnips then, you know, you all want us to live in this very poor lack of material culture kind of parsimonious way, which obviously we don't, but they are of interest and we can't deny that they happened. And we have to account for them, so we have to know about them, account for them. And I think that to the extent that they did inform the communist movement in Europe, communist socialist movement in Europe, is significant in terms of the understanding of what socialism is as an idea. But I think that we need to say, well, we need to step back away and say, well, yeah, They're interesting up to a point, but we have to put forward, we've got a different idea about what socialism would entail.
Thanks, Bill.
I was going to ask if you wanted to come back in, Howard. Or do you agree with what Bill says?
Yes, sort of. Yeah, certainly I agree with the last thing he said, yeah.
Okay, high praise indeed. Okay, Paddy then, please.
Well, two things. Just what Howard just said. If you look at you know, if you look at the diggers, for example, you know, we often quote Winstanley, don't we? But we know that that was a sort of religious community. I mean, we're aware of that. But, you know, do we dissociate completely from everything Winstanley said? No, of course we don't, you know. So, you know, you take the lessons from these things that are worth taking. And, you know, the very fact that these people were, you know, often religious in nature, I think is, you know, you're aware of that, but you put that on one side and you sort of, you take the positives. But that wasn't what I was going to say, actually. What I was actually going to say was, I've got to answer a previous point when, you know, Bill mentioned the fact that, well, you know, if you're in the one of these kind of communities and you're sort of shut off from the modern society, because you're shut off from modern health benefits. Well, it just happened coincidentally that this morning, today, I just listened to a podcast from The Economist. I'm a bit of a convert to podcasts lately, and the Economist have a good one called The Intelligence. They do it every day, sort of three items that are interesting. And one of the items was on a group called the Bajau, I don't know how you say it. Anyway, they're a group of sort of itinerant, sort of peripatetic fisher nomads. So they live on fishing, and they sort of live all around the coast of the South China Sea. So they basically live all over the place. Anyway, the point about them is that they don't belong to any state. For historical reasons, they never became part of any state, so they don't belong to any state to this day. And they're sort of, I suppose you'd call them fisher gatherers. And this is regarding the podcast was treating this as, oh, it's a terrible problem, you know, oh dear me, oh, you know, how awful is this, you know, they fished all these waters for centuries, but they're not citizens of any state. Well, that must be so difficult for them, and this was taken as such a sort of unquestioned assumption that it made me kind of prick my ears up and sort of listen to it properly. And, you know, because my first thought was like, oh, what are these terrible disadvantages that they've got by not being, you know, citizens of a state? And, so some were presented like, you know, they don't have access to, you know, modern education. But of course, I thought, well, yeah, but they've been living this like this for centuries, perfectly happily, as far as I can work out. So the only reason they would want access to sort of modern capitalist state education is so that they can then make their way in a modern capitalist state. In other words, you know, escape from their own community into the world of capitalism. So that kind of presupposes a whole set of things by itself. But one story they tell, I thought was really interesting. They tell a story about this one guy who's, he's about 40, and he gets ill with blood poisoning in the tribe or however the groups are called, and he does actually get taken to a state hospital, but they can't do anything for him, and he dies in the state hospital. But then what happens is that his father then gets presented with a $4,000 bill. Which, of course, he can't pay because they don't use money. They, you know, they've got no part of the capitalist system. They're not involved in it at all. How is he supposed to pay a £4,000 bill? And the podcast presents this as the sort of terrible dilemma of these tribes. But it occurred to me that, you know, this tribe has been living like this for centuries, you know, possibly even thousands of years. You know, this poor guy, probably if he'd got blood poisoning, he probably would have died anyway. But his dad wouldn't have got presented with a $4,000 bill from some state. So I wonder from their point of view, you know, whether they really appreciate this, the benefits of state citizenship that the Economist podcasters kind of took for granted. Anyway, simply an observation.
Nothing to add there, I don't think.
Okay, Comrade Buick. Sorry for the delay. I was trying to find a related document. So if you could go ahead, please, Adam.
I don't think this is just a question of history, because there are people today who are advocating what Cabe and the others, Owen, were advocating in the 1840s. I mean, a good example of this would be the person whose book was reviewed in last month's Standard by Howard, Anitra Nelson. Her view of how to get to socialism is, I think, precisely to set up more or less self-sufficient, or as self-sufficient as possible, small communistic communities that don't need money. So I think, in fact, the same discussion is going on today as went on in France in the 1840s. People wanted communism. I've read Cabet's Voyage to Icaria, and it's advocating a communist society. No doubt people like Marx and Engels, well, they didn't invent the idea of communism or socialism. It was an idea that was already around. But the question arose, how to get there? Do you go off and try to establish communistic colonies, or do you stay within capitalism and struggle to on a social level to get rid of the capitalist system? So I think this isn't just a historical thing; it's contemporary. But incidentally, in Bill mentioned the question of democracy. I think that we've always recognised that there are limits to democracy. In Voyage to Icaria, people have to wear the same clothes, and people have to live in the same houses of the same size, because they want absolute equality. I don't know whether they try to enforce this in the Icarian communities that they set up in America and in France, but socialists have always recognised that there are limits to what a majority can decide. The majority can't decide or shouldn't decide what people wear, or what their ideas are, what food they eat, and so on. I mean, democracy doesn't extend across the board. If it does, you get the nightmare of the Paracom system, where people do precisely what Bill said happened in some of these communes. Instead of your boss deciding how hard you work and giving you points and assessments, it's your fellow workers, and instead of it applies to consumption too. Before you can consume anything, you have to present a list of what you want to consume in the following year, which is decided by your neighbours whether this is all right. So some of these ideas are pretty restrictive. But I think the point Bill makes is that what they were trying to do was to establish a society based on, at least the Carians and the Harmonists, society based on common ownership, from each according to his ability, to each according to their needs, and and no money. So I mean, that's what they were trying to establish, but only on a small scale. And the practical problems that arise in a small scale community are not the same as those that would arise in a society wide community. But as I say, I imagine that the situation in France in the 1840s was similar to that in Britain. Well, in the 1960s, 1970s, and to a lesser extent today. Well, what do you do if you want a moneyless society or a no money society? Do you go off and establish communes or villages, or do you stay within capitalism and try to work to overthrow it? Okay, how do I get rid of my hand?
I did it for you.
No, I just say it says, okay, if I click it, it'll come back again. Okay, I know how to mute myself.
Okay. Right. In the absence of any questions, any hands up, I've got a fairly simple question for you, Bill. Why was it that the Shakers wanted celibacy? Is it similar to the early Christians that they thought that that Jesus was on his way back, and they wanted to be as pure as possible when that happened? Is that the reasoning, or do you know? Sounds a very strange idea to me.
Well, I don't know. I think it was just a particular question of theology. Yes, procreation was forbidden. This Wikipedia article is quite clear. It doesn't really say what where that doctrine comes from. But presumably, I mean, in some ways, there is a question of whether that was what was one of the reasons why, you know, getting rid of sexual competition, did it enable them to therefore get along together better if they once they've established that their sort of thing is not going to take place. So they were founded in England and went to, and this is again a thing. Some of these communities, they really were. People were persecuted over here. They went over there and they tried out their ideas in reality. So they're kind of part of that whole 17th / 18th century Protestant kind of flow of ideas that came about and presumably was enabled by the existence of. The United States or America being available to people to break out from the European society.
Right. Okay. Paddy?
Sorry, I know I've spoken a lot, but I just remember listening to, I've just been kind of listening to podcasts on the history of ancient Rome going right through to about 400 AD. And one of the points that gets made is one of the reasons why the Roman Empire finally had to kind of deal with the Christians, you know, to the extent of incorporating them into the sort of administration of the empire, was that the Christians had developed a sort of ghost administration that became as powerful and as well organized as the Roman imperial administration. But one of the key differences with the Christians was that they operated a kind of meritocracy within the ranks. So initially the early Christians had there was no thing about celibacy at all, but there was a thing about being anti-dynastic. So that a dynasty couldn't form amongst the Christians, so it would remain powerful because it would be a meritocratic form and therefore more efficient than the established imperial form. So it was this is why it was such a so competitive that the imperial administration couldn't really deal with it. You know, it was kind of a bit similar to the mafia, I suppose, in Italy. You know, it was a sort of shadow government, and I might be wrong, but I think that the whole kind of celibacy thing came in as a sort of offshoot of this opposition to the sort of corruption of dynastic regimes. But I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I'm just offering that as a possibility.
Right. Okay. Thanks, Paddy.
I mean, just looking very briefly at the perfectionists. So apparently, one of the reasons why they eventually failed was that the leadership passed from the original founder Noyes to his son, who wasn't a believer. So in the end, they they sold themselves up, turned themselves into a limited company, which seems to be the other outcome of these setups. That they're maybe not so much a precursor to communism as to corporate capitalism.
Just right, as nobody else is indicating a need to desire to speak. Just one observation about the I think Anitra is she called this Australian theorist. One of the things that infuriated me when I read, or sorry, when I watched the video. It's no money backwards. Whatever no money is backwards. That's the name of the video. They're just ignoring the fact that, and again, it seems to be they want to. She's advocating small groups, small production groups, as self-sufficient as possible, but not realizing that at the edges of that self-sufficiency, they'd be needing to trade something in order to be able to get the stuff that they couldn't produce themselves. And what she absolutely fails to understand is that the market price is for any goods that these people could produce will not be determined by these people using handloom weaving or whatever, is determined by the industrial system, so that anything that these people would, that their production will be totally inefficient, and it will soon fall down, and it would soon economically be broken by the capitalist system. So this idea, I mean, to me, it's just utter nonsense. What this type of theory is suggesting, purely because of the economics, as per usual. Okay. That's it.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think that is kind of the root cause of the downfall, is that once you get to industrial capitalism, I mean, yes, you probably could have coding, you know, software communes. There's a book by Marge Piercy, He, She, It, Body of Glass, I think is the British title, where you know, it's a cyberpunk future, and there's a commune that's set up around providing software. Which is, yes, it's viable, but you know, at some point, where do the computer parts come from? You know, this sort of thing. So, yes, I think that practicality is modern industrial capitalism has, if this was even ever a viable project as a way for the future of humanity, I think that industrial capitalism has made it unviable, and we have to go through the political route using political power to take control of the means of production. There's a stunning revelation for you all. The Socialist Party programme is right.
Comrade Buick, contradict that if you dare.
Well, no, I won't want to contradict that. But I'm not sure in that video that Anitra Nelson did, that she's advocating, she envisages the whole world composed of these relatively small scale communities and exchanging with each other, but not on the basis of money or of world prices. I mean, the objection that you raised is how would you get there if you start setting them up now? They're not going to be able to spread, so that they could, even her program could only be initiated if what you know, Bill has just said. You have to get rid of capitalism first, and then you can try and put this into practice. So I think it's the same. I think with what's his name, Robert Owen, and he envisaged a cooperative commonwealth, which wouldn't just be, it should be a whole, you know, a network of communistic communities or communistic villages and so on. So, but that was the objective. That was probably the only way people could imagine communism at that time, like it, same as the time of the diggers. But once you've got industrial, industrial capitalism, it becomes different. In fact, the more popular movement towards the end of the 19th century in America was Looking Backward by Edward Bellamy. I mean, they call themselves a nationalist, but that means they wanted everything to be owned nationally. And that made more sense towards the end of the century, and made more, you know, they were more, and it was a transition to the people there becoming some people there becoming becoming socialists. But I suppose that what Anita Nelson is saying is, look, you know, the same as Paddy said in his first intervention, these things show that this can work. So that might be some sort of a justification for it, but. As we know, these will be oceans of, or maybe islands in the middle of a capitalist ocean, and they would be subject to outside pressures. And all the ones that ever have been established, you know, have been, you know, the Bill mentioned what happened to the kibbutzim and all these various crops. Incidentally, the party's got a draft pamphlet called "What's Wrong with Workers' Cooperatives?" I mean, it deals with these, you know, these sort of issues to how you can't have islands of communistic or islands of cooperation within capitalism. I mean, the text is ready; it's all been set up. We're just waiting for it to be published.
Okay. If I could just make clear, I was more concerned about this Nelson's idea about piecemeal building of these societies as a sort of example, because they were definitely fail, just as these earlier ones did. That was my, you know, not talking about it as a worldwide system. They'd never get to a worldwide system with their views, and that's the issue, and that's the thing that we've got to keep pushing to. Bill, as no one else has, unless anybody's not spoken, if anybody wants to come in and make a contribution, I think that maybe I ought to invite Bill to make any summary that he'd like to. If you'd, anybody, John, comrade, come in. Good to hear from you, sir. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I just wanted to say something about the hostility that that's generated in the rest of society against those little groups, and what's happened ever since the 17th century and before, no doubt, that any of these groups that set up anything a bit more egalitarian or anything that seems to threaten the status quo. Private property and so on tends to generate some hostility. There was one that I remember quite vividly from the 1980s during the Thatcher regime, and these were people who I think had taken to the road because of the problems of capitalism, like difficulty in getting jobs and so on. And I remember a gang of police attacking a bus full of women and children, a prettily painted bus, I think, if I recall correctly. And I thought the police were setting dogs on the people. But in actual fact, it was the police themselves who were barking while they smashed the windows of this bus. And the hostility that was generated was really quite awful. And government ministers, including Thatcher herself, said, well, if you would just live in houses like everyone else, you wouldn't suffer this. So they were given really short shrift. And these were quite nice people that were just trying to live. And they had been forced on the road, I think, as I recall. So according to Tebbit's doctrine of get on your bike or get on your bus and look for work, you can only look for work in their terms. You have to be obviously prepared to subject yourself to wage slavery. Any little attempt at finding yourself, and I think offends against many supporters of capitalism today. So that's an additional problem about all these communes and groups. I think they can probably work within capitalism. For some people, I would imagine it would probably work better for quite highly paid people or better than average paid people who are able to do other work and make it pay as well as run this commune. But I don't think it's really for us to suggest ways of how this might work. I think we have to just further our own particular case. So that's just my contribution. The hostility that's generated against these things is another reason why it's very difficult while you've still got capitalist society.
Yeah, I think I'd completely forgotten about all of that. You reminded me, you're referring to the New Age Travellers, and very, very quick bit of Googling on Wikipedia, the Battle of Beanfield.
I think that might have, I was trying to find a video of that horrible scene with the police smashing these buses. It was absolutely horrific. And as I say, I thought the police had dogs. They maybe did have some dogs, but they were actually barking themselves while they smashed these windows. They were behaving like, well, what people call animals. We're all animals, but they were behaving like particularly nasty, vicious beasts.
Yeah, and I think that this does bring up, I mean, partly back to what I said just not long ago, that the power of the state would be used, and the power people with vested interests in current society would not allow these islands of socialism to threaten the general system peacefully. They would start to use the state actively if it was of any serious threat. And I think that although the various sects in America probably were very fit too small in the final analysis to be anything other than a threat. Although I think the original Icarians, when I was reading up about them earlier on, part of the problem with their first colony was the rules of homesteading that the I think Texas government had applied to them meant that they couldn't have contiguous land. So they had to have lots of plots all over the place, which probably didn't help them with starting setting up their commune from the get-go. There doesn't seem to be a route around needing to deal with the political power side of things. I think that there is an element of if they challenge status quo sufficiently, yes, hostility will be unleashed. And you know, these New Age Travellers are now remembered more by the name Crusties, and that's much more of a term of abuse. In fact, it's the Wikipedia article Crusties redirects to New Age Travellers. That's how they're going to be remembered for centuries to come. Assuming, unless anyone else is going to jump in,
I was going to ask you, Bill, whether if you wanted to sum up.
I think that is actually a reasonably good summing up that point, which is that just to reiterate, I think that there is something interesting to read about in these. In these communes, and they do point to the possibility of what some people see that socialism might well be like, you know, if we have the life enough and time. I don't think that they are a viable project to take us forward. No objection to people going and living on a commune if they really want to. But as a historical part of, we need part of our memory of, as a class, about where the idea of socialism came from, the fact that we can't, that you know, that people did live in communities without buying and selling among themselves, that lasted for quite some while, and that were for the most part democratic, and it seems unobjectionable to live in. For most people, and to freely, I think someone mentioned about having to buy in. I think some of them, you were allowed to buy out as well. They basically turn around to you and say, well, here's your stake. If you want to leave, take it and go. And I think that's where we can leave it. I think that's enough said. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Bill. Thank you for your talk, and thank you to everybody else for attending. Very interesting. Okay. Right.
Thanks, Bill. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you. I'll-